This is supposed to be the night when I don't come prepared with a talk and everybody's supposed to ask questions, but it sometimes doesn't work out that way. So I've taken to preparing a few random things anyway to see if it just stimulates people. I found this quote today from an article on 5 questions that make astrobiologists squirm. And I thought this was kind of interesting. It seemed related to what we were talking about earlier, before the sitting, about ants. I don't know. I'll just read it and you'll see if it sounds like it's related at all. Ariel Ambar, an astrobiologist at Arizona State University in Tempe, says most of his colleagues think that life inevitably emerges as a way for planets to dissipate energy trapped, in quotes, in the form of chemical disequilibrium. That is, sort of like the way convection currents arise in a hot pot or in the Earth's mantle to help heat escape, says Ambar. But he says the fact that this is what life seems to do does not mean that the emergence of life is inevitable. I thought that was interesting because I think about what life is sometimes, and I think that's to think of yourself as just something that this planet is doing to dissipate heat is kind of puts a little bit of perspective on things. Maybe as the members of Spinal Tap said when they were at the grave of Elvis Presley, it puts too much perspective on things. And I thought I'd also try reading this little essay that Cobuccino, well, it's not really an essay, he gave a talk and somebody turned it into an essay. And it's about the fifth precept, I'll just read it to you. It says, fifth precept, no selling the wine of delusion. Sometimes it's given as no selling wine, no drinking wine. Sometimes it's given as don't take intoxicants. This one, no selling of wine, the wine of delusion. And the version attributed to Bodhidharma, which Bodhidharma probably did not write, self-nature is mysteriously profound, truth of original basic purity, not to give birth of ignorance, I guess he means to ignorance, is called no selling wine, no drinking wine. So here's what Cobuccino says. We try not to intoxicate our body and mind, because if we go along with the heavy trip of intoxication, a very powerful life or chemical takes over our life. We don't know what was eaten, what was taken, or what was given. The unity of energy with other existences is very delicate, and if we are intoxicated, we lose the opportunity to unite with them. In a sense, nothing is wrong to do. Right and wrong are just our way of perceiving things and evaluating how human life can be, either in good shape or very dangerous shape. Our body decides what to do about bodily intoxication, but our mind is open to enormous amounts of teaching of many kinds. Those teachings work powerfully with the mind. So to delude the true nature is what we call intoxication. Hopefully, we will observe our whole life with the Buddha's body and mind and live through this life without much delusion. Once we give our lives to delusion, we lose contact with many important things and people. Keep your mind clear and let it penetrate through things and all people and situations. That is why the precepts are offered. They are not just to prohibit you from doing one thing or another, but to keep your true nature functioning at its best. This precept can literally refer to wine as well as other things which intoxicate our body and mind. This desire for intoxication has lasted for centuries and centuries, and the more heavily we get into illusion or delusion, the more removed we are from ourselves. Bodhidharma says that self-nature, our true nature, is a fantastic thing, and yet illusions and delusions take over and cover up our true nature. Then we are helpless. We cannot recover by ourselves. The powerful forces of love, compassion, and extreme clarity of mind, which let a dynamic body be in the right place at the right time, aren't easy to sustain, especially when we intoxicate ourselves over and over again and spoil ourselves. So these words, no selling the wine of delusion, are kind words. There are many stories about uncontrolled, helpless situations caused by the powerful effects of intoxication on our delicate bodies and minds. You drink strong wine and step on an insect, unaware. In the next life, you will be born as that insect. Watch out, Dave. And then you will be stepped on by a drunken man. If you wish to control or conduct yourself well, the only way is by inner recognition of yourself. At first, curiosity about intoxication and the relatively gentle effect of intoxication washes over you. If it becomes a habit, you don't know whether it is you intoxicating the wine or the wine intoxicating you. It becomes continuous, ongoing relationship. Using heavy liquor is like taking a lot of sugar, continuously causing you to be sick. Eating rich food all the time makes you diabetic. Strong wine or whiskey makes your brain fogged and doesn't let your brain recover. Smoking is the same, and there is a powerful mind reaction to marijuana. I had one terrible experience. I thought I could sit in zazen after drinking quite a lot of sake, and it was terrible. The body is like a boneless creature if you drink too much. You cannot even walk straight. If you have no control over intoxication, it is best to give it a vacation. Refrain from that state for 2 or 3 days and see how the body feels. It is important to develop your experience of the cleansing sensation. Even a so-called religious way can be the wine of delusion. Many times we call on spiritual subjects in order to polish ourselves, but these can have the same effect as wine. When some religion causes you to become excited, bringing you to a state of ecstatic excitement, you'd better think that this isn't the ultimate. Yet there are many religions which focus on an ultimate state. If zazen practice makes you feel like that, your zazen is not the right one. An intoxicated, agitated state is the opposite from great wisdom, opposite from a clear perspective on what this existence, this life, is all about. Great wisdom is something which makes you want to deeply appreciate yourself and others. If practice causes that deep appreciation and respect, there is peace and satisfaction. That is what real religion does. Then one has perfect contact with the self, with the ultimate. The end. That's what Koban says about that precept, and I've been arguing with people on the internet all weekend about it. So that's been fun. Actually, I find most people understand what I've been saying about that. But there you go.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, it's been a couple hard last few weeks and stuff with anxiety and depression, and I was wondering if, is that like reality?
Is anxiety and depression reality?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know how we talk about reality in Buddhism, mm-hmm. and stuff, and it's like it's not kind of what it is and stuff. And then when you have those episodes and stuff, is it? How do you stay present in it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when it feels like, you know, you're in agony, you're. And everything that goes along, or do you try to just say, like, this, everything changes, so this will change, but will this change into something even worse?
It's possible.
You know, and that was what, that whole thing.
Yeah, I don't know. There's something, Nishima Roshi used to talk about depression sometimes, that's my teacher in Japan, and he always related it to being clever. He wouldn't say smart or intelligent, like clever. So he would say that clever people are more prone to depression. And I think he probably counted himself among that group of people. And I never heard it put that way. But when he started saying that, I could kind of see how if you think about things a lot, you can always find some reason to be depressed about things. If you just think about it, there's always some angle that makes you feel bad about it. But then there's this sort of chemical depression thing, which is something I think you've heard me say this before, but I never got diagnosed or anything, but my self-diagnosis is that I'm a person prone to that sort of thing, because it would always go in kind of waves. And I sort of used to watch, after a while doing this zazen practice and having those episodes, I started being able to watch them from some sort of conceptual distance, and see that it kind of went in waves. I mean, I always think of it going like this, but it's more like this, right? You know, and I get depressed and depressed and depressed, and then at some point I kind of bottom out, and then things would start to get better. And it didn't seem to make that much difference what was actually going on in my life. These waves would kind of come, you know. Sometimes there was plenty to be depressed about and I wasn't feeling depressed, and sometimes things were going very well and then I just fall into this depressed state anyway. So I learned to kind of wait them out. I started to think of it the way I think of having a cold, which is like, okay, I got a cold and it sucks, but if I take it easy, I'll get over it. So I started looking at depression that way and going, well, you know, if I kind of take it easy, I can get over it. Whether the depression is reality or not, I think it's kind of a way of framing things. And sometimes you're framing things in a way that makes them look depressing, and sometimes you're framing the same things in a way that makes it look not depressing. There's a spider, looked like he was being chased by an ant.
It's very possible.
Yeah.
Ant war.
Yeah. So the ants are really aggressive. They're chasing spiders now. But so you know, you just. At some point, any sort of every situation you're in will pass, and yeah, you could think, well, it might get worse, it might not get worse, and there's no real predicting how anything is going to go, you know, and so I kind of look at it that way. There's always different ways of framing things for yourself. And I'm not, you know, when I first just had started getting into Zazen, I was living in this sort of punk rock house with different people living in different rooms, as they do in those houses. And there was a woman living there, and she was all into positive thinking, and she kept, you know, preaching the gospel of positive thinking all over the place. And she went through some real episodes. We finally kind of had to ask her to leave because she became a problem in the house with all the positivity didn't seem to be working. And I really thought, oh, maybe this whole positivity thing is, and ever since then I've been really skeptical of trying to replace depression with positivity. You know, that's sort of the angle most people go for, I think. And so my way of dealing with it, for whatever it's worth, is just to kind of allow the depression to be there. And while it's there, I try as much as possible not to believe it. You know, it's just sort of a thing that's going on, and I sort of accept that, okay, this is the state of my body mind right now, and I'll just stay with it. I'm not going to try to push it away. I'm not going to try to embrace it. I'll just, you know, hang out with it for a while and hope that it passes. And it always has. You know, I still get these. These episodes don't seem to be as strong or as long lasting as they used to be. But I had one like a month ago that was like, oh, okay, it's still there. You know, something I can count on. You know. And I did the same thing. I just kind of said, okay, here it is, and I'm just going to stick with it. You know, you can always try to fix your external circumstances, and often that works, you know. But I think it's more of how you choose to, not choose is probably not even the right word. It's more how you frame things, and whether you can choose that or not, I don't know.
I don't know if it, I have a subject, not necessarily really a question, maybe it's a question.
All right.
Words
uh-huh.
have been, I had this like hangover from studying so much. It's on vacation, I just read and sat and ate and read and sat and ate, and I was just like oversaturated. I've been really struggling with words. Words and language, I guess.
Okay.
Like, are they, I guess if it was a question, it would be, are they friend or enemy or friend?
That's the question?
Yeah.
Friend or enemy or frenemy? You mean words?
Words and language. Words.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because it's, as far as we know on this planet, among the living things, the only ones that really deal with words are us. You know, I always watch these talking parrot videos, and there's these things. There was one parrot, he even has a name, and he seems to understand the words he's using. You know, and the person who was, it was a scientist, like a linguist or somebody, who was training this bird just to understand how language works, and it trained this bird to understand certain words, and proved pretty convincingly that they can understand it. But even so, they don't seem to use it. You know, other animals communicate, but they don't communicate at the level of intricacy and sophistication that we do. So they can tell each other that they're tired or they're angry or they're, you know, in a wide range, you know, a sort of wide swath. I'm taking care of my neighbor's cats, and one cat was having a territorial dispute with another cat, and I had to go break it up today. And I, you know, they were communicating, but not in very, you know, precise terms. But they were definitely communicating. And so I think it's something that's been very good for us, obviously, because it's allowed us to communicate with each other and, you know, get to the point of being able to build houses and roads and cars and all sorts of stuff. And we have all this convenience and comfort because of it. But on the other hand, sometimes I wonder how much we're able to communicate. Because, I mean, I write for a living and do all sorts of communication for a living. And I realize when I write something or put something out as a video or whatever, a talk like this, and then I see what comes back to me from it, I go, oh, you know, I thought I was being very precise, but that, what I just said, was not understood, you know. Or whatever's coming back to me is just doesn't match what I was trying to put out there. So I don't know. I think there's an idea in Zen about the teaching that is beyond words and letters is how they usually translate it, but it's from Chinese, so the letters themselves are words. So, you know, I think it's concepts and words is more probably a better translation. And it says that Zen is beyond that, and so what we're trying to reach for in this practice is a kind of teaching that doesn't really rely on words. It can be, you can kind of convey some of it through words, but it doesn't, you know, you're not relying on the concepts. I remember when Nishijima Roshi had gone to Israel, and he came back, and he said he had some conversations with some rabbis over there, and he said, I realized the difficulty of trying to follow ancient texts. because they were, you know, a lot of them were arguing about the, you know, the Bible and things like that, and trying to how to interpret it. But although Nishijima was also a Zen person and a scholar of ancient words, the sense that we have in Zen is we're not trying to like say, well, Dogen is absolutely right and we must, you know, follow his words and try to interpret what he said. It's more like, well, you know, he's just a person saying things, and we try to grasp a little bit of that. So I think it's a frenemy, you know. I think it's something that's useful, but I think it's very easy to get intoxicated with it and to think you understand somebody because you heard the words they're saying, I think is often a mistake. So I try as much as possible not to do that, you know, and I try not to argue with people by saying, well, you said that, you know, because often I realize that people are saying something that probably is only an approximation of what they really mean anyway. So, yeah, frenemy. Yeah. Should we keep going?
Cool.
I like the headband.
I took a shower and wanted my hair to lay down.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, my question. So, like, Zen has obviously gone through, like, different societies, like China, mm-hmm. Japan, here. My question is Zen, since it seems kind of like, I guess, the opposite of our current, like, societal paradigm, is it sort of, like, the beginning of, like, us rejecting this society? Mm-hmm. Is it to help us, like, deal with it? Or is it just unconcerned with societies?
Oh God!
Yeah. I like the question. I'm just like,
that's a big question. Gosh, you know, it's interesting because I just did this video today, which is, I guess, it's a little bit related to that idea that I've been having these arguments about intoxication and Buddhism and how to deal with psychedelics as a thing, and in the video I was saying, well, the Zen kind of entered American society at the same time as psychedelic drugs entered American society, and so a lot of people conflated the two as if it was like part of the same thing, and I think that was, there was a lot of confusion, and I think if you reflected that back, if you said to a Japanese person, you know, as Japanese Zen priest, yeah, psychedelics are the way to understand Zen, they'd be like, what the hell are you talking about? You know, it wouldn't make any sense. This whole idea that there could be any connection between the two would just seem bizarre. So I think in terms of society, I think it kind of came to American society at a point where American society was trying to reevaluate its values. We're kind of looking at the values that we developed as a society and saying, well, this didn't lead us where we thought it would. And Nishijima used to have this funny way of explaining history. He'd say that, and he would talk about world culture, but he was more talking about Western culture, I think, which he considered to be like the dominant world culture, even though he was Japanese. That we went through this period of being of idealism, of being steeped in this world of ideas and concepts, to where people almost didn't understand the material world existed because it wasn't really important to them. And then he would say, and then in the Middle Ages or the Renaissance period, people discovered they had bodies. And I was like, wow, that's weird, weird way of putting it. But I think I can understand what he was saying, because there's this sort of like, oh, there's this other aspect, there's this material aspect, and this, as a society, we started really focusing on that, of building up the material infrastructure and whatnot, so that more people could live comfortably, and, you know, people started inventing things, and we started getting running water everywhere, and electricity, and gas-powered vehicles, and airplanes, and all this stuff, and with the idea that I think the people who first embarked on this study of materialism were thinking, okay, this is the way, we're going to fix everything, and you can see, if you look at literature written in the 19th century, there's a lot of optimism that we're going to solve everything, you know, we're going to just make everybody happy and comfortable, and we're finally going to have paradise on earth once we get, you know, electricity in every home and water and all this other stuff. But it didn't turn out that way. In the 20th century, it all kind of started to backfire. You can especially see this in World War II, where all of that technology that was supposed to make us better started to be used for horrible things, like terrible weapons and concentration camps and atomic bombs and all this other stuff. So I think that was a big shock to Western civilization in general. So you see in the years after World War II, people starting to go, what the hell? You know, there was this kind of lull in the 50s where people were like, oh, okay, everything's peaceful now, let's try to get back to the, you know, the being happy about flush toilets and televisions. And it wasn't working, you know. And so in the 60s, you have this generation of people who started to reject that. But now we've kind of come to this impasse where, as a society, we've already kind of gone through the phase of this idealistic realm and gone, well, that didn't work, and then materialism didn't work. And so a lot of people sort of confusedly would be trying to go back to the idealism of the previous experiment, societal experiment, but that's not going to work. You can't really go there anymore because we kind of know too much about that, but you can't go back to materialism. And so I do think, to your point, I think this is where Buddhism started to become a factor in Western society, at this point. And people started going, oh, okay, well, maybe there's Nishijima used to be very insistent that Buddhism was a completely different way that was not materialistic, but was not, you know, another word for idealism is spiritual, you know, so you'd often use that word. You say it isn't a spiritual practice, but it isn't a materialistic practice either. It's something that's trying to kind of go beyond both of those. So I think in terms of your question, I think that's where we're at now, and we're trying to find our way. And to me, I think Nishijima was right. I listened to him say this, you know, he'd say it over and over and over. And for the first couple of years, I just kind of go, I don't know what the hell you're talking about. And after a while, I started going, oh yeah, I see what you mean. It's sort of, it is like that. We're trying to find this way that isn't, it acknowledges that there's a spiritual or idealistic aspect to our existence. And there's also this materialistic aspect to our existence, and we're trying to kind of balance those two and make something else out of it. So, yeah, I think it's trying to, in our society, it's trying to address that. But I think there's this tendency to take it the wrong way and go, oh, it's spirituality, and it's part of this movement back to spirituality, but I don't think it is, because it's saying, yeah, there's definitely a material world, and we've got to deal with that. Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Thanks for the question.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to ask Ed Kaplan's question.
Okay.
Ed Kaplan is a long-time commentator and liker of our stuff on the internet. Thank you, Ed. Okay, it's a long question.
No.
But it's a really good question.
Okay.
We have also a 15-minute warning, so...
Yeah, I know.
He says, having spent many years in different religious communities, we are always careful to distinguish between our rabbi's opinion and the congregation's opinion. The congregation represents the far range of people's viewpoints, no matter what the mission is, no matter how the practice is defined. I guess I understand this dynamic relationship between a congregation or community and its leader. In another setting, Brad, you would never express your opinion on drugs and Buddhism so vehemently, so personally, without at least understanding that as the leader of a community, you might consult the community. You might even want to work out your suppositions with them before publicly putting them in the position to defend you. The real question here is, in American Zen, does the Zen leader understand these dynamics of organization, democracy, and respect? I look forward to some discussion of this tonight. Thank you so much for always your devotion. You probably don't see it that way.
Well, I don't know. Should I have consulted everybody before I said something about drugs? I mean, I kind of see myself as not a leader of a community, but just one of the people in it, and I write books and started the place. But I'm not trying to speak for everybody. I don't know. I think there is a dynamic there. I don't know. My own way of doing it is I never try to impose my stuff on this particular community. And that's one of the reasons I stopped being the only guy who talks. You know, for the first several years we did this thing, I was the guy who gave all of the talks. And then a few years ago, I sort of deputized some other people. And now other more people have been deputized. And now I feel like I'm just one of a revolving cast of characters. Which is fine, you know, with me. I'm perfectly happy with that. You know, if I ever saw anybody kind of giving a talk that I thought kind of crossed the line, I think I might be inclined to let them talk and then afterwards kind of say, hey, you know, I'm not sure we want to be talking about that kind of stuff here. But that hasn't happened yet, so, you know, and maybe it never will. But that would be the only extent I would try to impose things. And I would expect, though, that other people within the community would probably also do the same thing if somebody really kind of got out of line. You know, one of the people who gives talks here started saying some crazy stuff. I don't know what they'd say, but you know, whatever. So, I'm not sure I can answer that question very well, because it's not the way I conceive of things. I don't conceive of myself as a rabbi who's speaking for a congregation or something like that. I try to offer whatever it is I have to the community. And with this stuff about intoxicants and all that, I thought it was important, because I and I could have been wrong, I didn't perceive a lot of the world of internet Buddhism as being ready to speak out against something like this. Like, they're always ready to jump on if there's a sex scandal. Like, if there's a sex scandal, everybody goes, you know, it's like a big dog pile. But there's other things that they don't, and this is sort of the internet Buddhist community, of which I guess I'm part too, they don't seem to get involved, you know, like oh, you know, like when Genpo Roshi was saying you could spend $5,000 and get enlightened in a day. No, nobody was saying anything about that. And I was like, why isn't anybody saying anything about that? You know, of course, and when Genpo Roshi had a sex scandal, it was like, you know, dog pile. I'm like, oh yeah, okay, well, fine. Yeah. I'm like, I don't care who he's, you know, if he's cheating on his wife. I mean, that's not nice, but that doesn't, to me, it seems like a bigger problem if he's selling enlightenment experiences for big money. That, I don't know, maybe my priorities are screwed, but to me that seems like a problem. Whereas the fact that he was cheating on his wife is like, well, that's not nice, you know, but I'm not out there ready to pummel him for that particularly. Yeah, so, and so the drug thing, I also saw, I you know, this last thing that I was reacting to was an article in Lion's Roar that I thought was pretty much promoting. There was one in Tricycle Magazine, which was a little bit equivocal, that came out a couple of weeks before, and I criticized that one, but not as strongly. And then the Lion's Roar piece comes out, and they're another big Buddhist magazine, and they're just like, full on, you know, drugs are the new thing. I'm like, really? Come on, you know, you're really gonna go there. And I thought it was important for somebody to say something, but I'm not trying to speak as this community. And I don't know that everybody agrees with me on that, but I think it's important. So I don't know, that's not really...
Instead of like, we're a democracy and you're a representative, it's more like it's more anarchist and you're a part of the speakers collective, you can say what you want to.
I guess so, yeah, I never really got the whole anarchy thing, but yeah.
It's complicated, it's more complicated, but
yeah, yeah.
I can explain it later.
Yeah, but I think maybe it is kind of like that, and I want to preserve some sort of a tone to this group, and I want to kind of, you know, I hope that to the extent that I'm able to, I can act as a sort of gyroscope, you know, to try to keep everything going, you know, in the right direction. I mean, the gyroscope, you put it in the ship and the ship doesn't tip over, right? And so I'm hoping maybe I can do that sort of thing, but I don't want to be the, you know, the leader of it that way. Good.
Hey Brett, could you talk about the difference between desire and attachment, whether there is?
These are such huge questions. Yeah, I'll try. I'll try to do it quickly. Yeah, one of the things, again, I keep referring to Nishijima, but one of the things he was on about a lot was that the standard version you'll often hear of the Buddhist Four Noble Truths is the truth of suffering. All life is suffering, and suffering is caused by desire, and if you cut off desire, you end suffering. And he used to object to that really strongly, because he would say, you can't cut off desire. Nobody can cut off desire. And that just doesn't seem like a good way to interpret this teaching of Buddha. And this is foundational stuff that he was kind of going against. But I think he was right. I think desire just arises, and you want food and you want sex and you want these things, but there's a certain way you can kind of let that be, and just kind of, well, I desire this. I think Zazen is a good way to kind of train with that, because you're fighting this basic desire to like get up and leave, you know, or whatever, and you're just gonna hold still. And this happens more on like a retreat than if you're just doing it 30 minutes, you don't get quite the full effect. But if you're doing a multi-day retreat, after a while you're just like, ah, you know, just trying. So that's the quick version of desire. Attachment is one, you know, I always have a problem with this, because people will interpret it in weird ways. Like, I wrote this in a book, but bunch of people wrote me emails at the same time that said kind of the same thing. Like, within a span of a week, I got like three of them. It was saying basically the same sort of story, like, well, I've heard there's a teaching of non-attachment in Buddhism, but I love my wife and children, and I don't know how to become less attached to them. I'm like, that's not, you know, at least that's not my way of understanding attachment as it comes in Buddhism, is like you don't love your wife and children, things like that. It's more of a attachment to me refers to that wanting to sort of fix things in a certain place. So it's not necessarily attachment to your children, but it could be attachment to your children as children, you know, to the point where when they grow up, you can't deal with them anymore because they've changed. You know, they're not little kids anymore. Now they're teenagers, and you're sort of forcing this image of being a small child onto a teenager, and that causes problems. And that's and in a more microscopic way, you kind of face that in Zazen. You have an attachment might be a feeling of, you know, you may, for example, as you're sitting, come across a moment when you feel very blissful and it feels great. And you start going, I want to hold on to that. But it goes away. And then you start feeling distressed because, like, it's gone away and there's nothing you can do to get it back. And that's, to me, that's the sort of attachment we're trying to work on. I mean, I could probably, like, each of these questions could probably be a whole talk, and now I feel bad that I read that whole Koban thing. I was afraid that people wouldn't want to talk, which sometimes happens, so. Okay, sorry. I'm gonna keep going. And you don't have to say anything if you don't want to.
All right. How do you, like, develop a more sense of detachment if you were, like, a high-pressure job?
A sense of detachment to a high-pressure job? Ooh, that's a tough one. I don't know. I watch, like, my girlfriend's, she was a teacher, now she works as a sort of coach to teachers, but her thing that I think causes her problems is she's a perfectionist, you know, so she wants to do everything right, and so she puts a lot of pressure on herself to be really good. And I always tell her, yeah, just slack off. And I wouldn't say that to everybody, you know. But to her, because I look at her and I think if she decided to slack off, what she would end up doing is sort of like a normal job, you know, the way a normal person works a job rather than trying to get everything exactly right all the time. And then she'd be kind of more comfortable. And I find that that's kind of the way. I never worked in a really high-pressure job, but I worked for a film production company, and I had kind of a minor role in it, and there was a bit of pressure there. And I always dealt with it by kind of keeping a certain set of boundaries of, okay, well, this is how much I will allow this job to influence my life and my, you know, my feelings of happiness and all that, and I'm gonna stop it, you know. I'm gonna just kind of let things go, and other people can freak out if they want, but I'm gonna keep doing a good job here. But I'm gonna just kind of say, okay, this is, you know, this is the job, and I'm gonna do it as best I can. And if it doesn't quite work, well, I'll try another thing. You know, I'm not trying to be lazy. I'm trying to be serious about it. But on the other hand, you know, things, you can't control things. You know, that's kind of an illusion. And people get this idea that you can kind of control the results. You can try something and then often it doesn't come out the way you think it will, no matter how well you calculate it. And you just kind of go, okay. So yeah, slack off is the answer.
Into your last internet question, if you want.
What's the deal with airplane food?
Radical, yeah. What's the deal with airplane food? Radical and engaged Buddhism. What's the deal?
Yeah. But I actually was looking up engaged Buddhism, and I found what I think might be the text of engaged Buddhism, which is this article written by Thich Nhat Hanh, who was the first guy, I think, who was promoting this idea of engaged Buddhism. And it was 14 points for engaged Buddhists. And I looked at him, I'm like, oh, I'm down with all these 14 points. I don't have any problem with that. My problem with engaged Buddhism, which I've talked to before, is it's not that it's a bad thing to be socially engaged as a Buddhist, but there's a tendency with everybody who gets into social engagement or social justice or whatever they're calling it these days, to kind of focus on these sort of sexy problems, you know, these problems that are creating a lot of waves, like the refugee thing or the stuff with the border these days in the US. And it's not that you don't deal with those, but I kind of always feel, and I say this a lot, that the immediate problems in your that are close to you are the ones that are demand more attention. Because those problems, like the problem of people crossing the Mexican border, I mean, it's a couple hundred miles away, but it's still far enough away. There's not much we can do about it. You know, I mean, you can vote and you can write your congressman and you can try to do a little bit, but you're not going to affect a major change down there. But people will put a huge amount of mental energy into it, as if like, you know, and get very upset about it. And the fact that they're powerless to do very much just increases that upset. And to me, that's a lot of wasted energy, which I'm not saying that it's a waste of energy to try to do something about the problems that are going on in the Mexican-American border. But it is a problem to waste a lot of energy, mental energy, that could be put to something else. You know, you do what you can, you write your congressman, you vote, you protest, you whatever you want to do, but realizing that you can only have that certain amount of effect on it, and then bring things closer in, you know, into your local community or even your own household, and see what needs to be done there, you know, and work on those things, and you can feel a lot better, because you can actually affect change. You can affect major change in the world by straightening up your room, you know. I mean, this is something I said in Hardcore Zen in like 14 years ago or more, and I still feel that way, and it you know, it doesn't solve the crisis of the border problems, but it does do something for your own peace of mind, which actually has an effect that most of us don't realize. You know, most of us are like, we haven't fixed all those problems over there. But you have kind of made your own situation a little better, so that the next time you have to have an interaction with a bigger problem, you're more able to face it, because you've gotten your own thing together a little bit. So that's what I think is the deal there. Oh my God, we went over time. Okay. So, here's the speech of money. We recommend a donation of $10 to $15 per sitting, because this place doesn't run on good vibes. We pay rent here, and I was just reminded how much we pay, because I'd forgotten. And it's not insubstantial, and we don't make it every month. We somehow have managed to hold on for the last year, but I always wonder how long it's going to go. So please give. And the best way to support us is, I mean, you can put money in the basket, and that's great, but if you go online and become a recurring member, that actually works a lot better for us, and thank you to everybody who already does that, and you can talk to Dave if you want to know how to do that. And that's it. We have a card reader, and we have a mailing list, and also Dave can take your email address if you want to be on that, and I think the emails are getting more entertaining each time, so yeah. I like what you're doing with them.
I also want to say thanks to everyone who came early and helped me up. That was great. I had a whole crew.